and welcome to Worlds Apart. It's become a cliche in Western circles to say that the Russian President Vladimir Putin has a poor hand of cards, but he plays them well. This may seem like a compliment to the Kremlin's tactical ability, but it ignores the fact that Russia has a lot of hard power resources to draw upon. How much has this narrative of Putin's poor hand of cards contributed to the current conflict in Ukraine? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Steve Jeremy, a retired Royal Navy Commodore and author of Strategy for Action, Using Force Wisely in the 21st Century. Mr. Jeremy, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure, Oksana. I think Mr. Putin has a very strong hand of cards, but I'm sure that that will come out in the talk.
You know, as I was preparing for this conversation, it occurred to me that your book's title sets a seemingly unreachable standard for policymakers because it encourages them to use force wisely. Before they get to wisdom, don't you think they need to acquaint themselves and master sanity first and foremost?
Yes, Oksana. The reason I wrote the book, and unfortunately it's not a plug because the book is out of print at the moment, although I'm doing a second edition, but the reason that I wrote it was those people could think properly before they entered into wars. Because many times if they did think properly and think in a more structured and intelligent way, then we wouldn't get into the wars in the first place.
And I think your book operates within this idea of a balance of power, which is a concept out of the realist school of thinking, but the current European leadership, I don't think they even recognize that such an idea exists. I mean, they seem to be operating on the premise that the world, the reality, should bend to their wishes rather than the other way around. Is there anything in your view that can still persuade them to coordinate their policies with what is rather than what they think it's supposed to be?
I think the thing that was going to persuade them eventually, I'm afraid to say, Oksana, is defeat of Ukraine, which I suspect will be later this year or sometime next year. And that will force them to recognize that they've actually got their calculations wrong. But the short answer is that the balance of power theory, well, it comes from the work of John Mearsheimer, who I'm sure you will know. But what I've done is develop John Mearsheimer's work. And when you do it, it's in a recent article I published that you and I just talked about. When you do that, it becomes immediately clear that no matter what one's moral position is on the war, and it's clear that the Western leaders, almost to a man or to a woman, believe that they hold the moral high ground of the war. I don't agree with that. But even if that were true, if the balance of power is not in their favor, but it is instead in Russia's favor, then it doesn't really matter. Because what matters is Russia's ability to see the military war through to a conclusion. And no matter how much the Western leaders might want to impose conditions on Russia that Russia doesn't want to accept, if the Western leaders don't have the power to impose those conditions, then it's all just meaningless discussion, political discussion.
Well, speaking about Russia's resources. I mentioned in my introduction this Western narrative that Putin has this poor hand of cards, but he plays them well. Do you think it's accurate, especially when you assess Russia's capacity through the lens of the balance of power concept?
I think the West have got it completely wrong. I think that Putin has a very strong set of cards. Indeed, I first started writing about this for the Naval Review back in September 2022, and then suggested that actually it was highly likely that Russia would win. In fact, I thought it was a racing certainty, and because the balance of power favored Russia, and the two fundamental features of the balance of power, certainly for military force, are industrial capacity and energy. And Russia is extremely well supplied with both. And we know, for example, that Russia is out-competing the West, the whole of the West, in the delivery of 155-millimeter shells. And if you take its oil and gas exports, it's the largest oil and gas combined exporter in the world. So it's completely independent in terms of energy. So Russia has a very good foundation.
I also heard you make the point before that it's not only about, you know, the hard power fundamentals, but also the motivation of the sides that determines how effectively that power is deployed. And I think you term it as the power of the balance, rather, of political passion. And I suppose passion, even political passion, is something that is very hard to put a precise number on. But I wonder, how would you go about calculating it or assessing it?
I think you have to calculate it qualitatively as opposed to quantitatively. But let me give you two historical examples, Oksana. The first is Vietnam, and the second is Afghanistan. I was involved in Afghanistan in the war in 2007. If you take both of those conflicts, in both cases, certainly in the first case in Vietnam, America had overwhelmingly the balance of military power, I would say, and yet lost the war. And in my view, that it was that it lacked the passion, the political passion over time to actually stick with the war. And so it was a defeat which cost America dear politically. And the same thing happened to NATO in Afghanistan. So we were defeated essentially by a ragtag bunch of Taliban who had little more than roadside IEDs and small arms. And yet again, we were defeated. And in both cases, it was because there wasn't the political passion in the West, in Vietnam, in America in the first place, and in the NATO countries in the second place, to pursue the war, whereas the balance of passion overwhelmingly favored the Viet Cong and overwhelmingly favored the Taliban. And they were prepared to expend much more in terms of blood and treasure than America was in the first place and the NATO was in the second place.
Now, when it comes to Russia and the expansion of NATO into Ukraine, which is the main structural reason for this conflict, I think it was pretty clear from the very beginning that Russia both had the existential motivation to resist it and the material capacity to do that. And yet the West pressed with this intention regardless of any Russia's objections or even, pretty clear signals like amassing a large number of troops on the border with Ukraine. How do you understand it?
I think the West, at a very fundamental level, has lost the capability to calculate the balance of power. We certainly have at the highest levels of government. So I see failures in amongst the military leaders thinking, failures amongst the diplomatic staff thinking, and failures in the economists as well. And ultimately, there's an issue here with Western judgment. And I think that one of the problems is that the West believes, and I think wrongly, that it has a morally righteous case, and that actually it is in the right. And you see this in all of the West's narrative. I don't happen to think that's true, but even if they had been in the right, had they done the calculations properly, and worked out what might happen in the war that is now playing out in front of us, then I think they might have taken a more cautious view. Unfortunately, they chose, despite many fantastic warnings from going back as far back as George Kennan in 1996 and running through the famous Niet means Niet telegram from Bill Burns in 2006, they chose willfully to ignore these warnings, to ignore the vice against expanding NATO, and instead willfully expanded NATO with no sense whatsoever of thinking it through.
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, reality has an uncanny capacity of, you know, foisting itself on those who deny it, even though there's always a pretty high price for, you know, siding with fantasies and illusions, especially in geopolitics. Now, when it comes to the war in Ukraine, it's pretty clear that Ukraine at this point of time is the biggest loser of all in terms of, blood and treasure. But what about Europe, including the UK? Is it gaining or losing from supporting this war?
Oh, we're losing. I can think of no reason why we might be winning. I mean, I think that the two institutions which I think the war could have a catastrophic effect on will be firstly NATO and secondly the EU. I mean, I think I've written in a recent article in Responsible Statecraft explaining that NATO is not the great alliance that people think, but rather are much weaker. And if even if NATO with America on board were to go to war with Russia, I don't want this to happen. It's the last thing that we would want. But NATO would lose a war against Russia. So it feels to me that NATO is well past its sell-by date. The problem with NATO is it has a strategy which it describes as collective security, but in truth, it's confrontational security. And what we really need, and I think I'm very much with all of the people who talk in this way, we need an approach to security which is cooperative amongst all the peoples in Europe, so that we can actually start talking to each other again and get back to a cooperative situation. So I think all will suffer badly, not only because of the expenditure of money and and military resources, but also because of the loss of reputation that is a consequence of this war.
Now, the balance of power theory is very rational. It draws on calculations, on logic, but human affairs, including governance, are not always logical. And in psychoanalysis, they even have a specific term for it, mortido, a drive to death, suicidal tendencies, which may take over when life as one imagines it is no longer possible. It's essentially a psychosis-driven process. And I mentioned that in relation to Ukraine and how much it has already lost and is likely to keep on losing. Is there a point in the balance of power theory when you stop considering an actor, be it Ukraine or NATO, as a rational one? And if that happens, how would you go on analyzing the actions of that actor?
I think the balance of power is one way to think about it, but there are other ways as well. When I wrote the book about military strategy, it was to encourage structured thinking about strategy. Sadly, it wasn't very much taken up by the West because we thought we were being successful despite defeats in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and now as the NATO proxy in Ukraine. But I think the issue here is that the West has been guided throughout this operation by a political narrative, and Russia has been guided by a military strategy. Military strategy is based on reality, it's based on the balance of power, amongst other things. And the political narrative essentially has been built around stories that we have, through spin doctors and a general unsad Russophobia, which I simply do not understand, but is now coming apart at the seams. So I think as the political narrative falls apart, then in the same way that markets fall apart from time to time, I think we'll see that narrative destroyed, and the West will have to confront what is a humiliating but well-deserved, I'm afraid, defeat.
Okay, well, Mr. Jeremy, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals? And what
planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Steve Jeremy, a retired Royal Navy Commodore and author of Strategy for Action, Using Force Wisely in the 21st Century. Now, Mr. Jeremy, this conflict had multiple junctures at which a peace deal could have been negotiated, and yet the Ukrainian side has been repeatedly encouraged to press on, including by the British politicians. We all remember the intervention of Boris Johnson in April of 2022, and his current counterpart or successor, Keir Starmer, seems to be following the same script. Why do you think the British are so consistent in playing this peace sabotaging role or peace prevention role?
I will be a bit delicate, Oksana, because I, for contractual reasons, my day job is working for a company which is associated local government. So if I may, I'll come back in terms not just of the British, but also of all of European leaders. One of the problems is that I think that European leaders have seduced themselves with the political narrative that they've created, which is based on a lot of it is incredibly poor analysis of the conflict and no knowledge whatsoever of history. I think that the problem they've faced, though, that this is all now coming apart. I think the reason that it's happening is difficult to understand, but it in part is to do with what you were talking about. It's what they call, in a wonderful book, the madness of crowds. So there is a lot of noise, and that noise is an echo chamber in which anybody who talks slightly against the conflict for in a more reasoned way isn't listened to or is described as a Putin advocate, whereas I tend to look at it really from realpolitik and strategic analysis ways. And that, if you are able to do that, it's much, much easier to think it through. But for the moment, I think it's very difficult to understand the European leaders' position, because almost everything that we are doing is extending the conflict. And on each time that we extend the conflict, then the terms that will be offered to Ukraine at the end of it get worse and worse and worse. This has gone on from Boris Johnson's intervention, when the terms are very reasonable, if you look back, from Mr. Putin, all the way through now to we're talking about the loss of 4 oblasts, possibly 5 oblasts, 7 oblasts, and much harsher terms. And at each stage, at any of these stages, had Europeans said to Americans, I think this is time for us to actually settle, then Ukraine will be in a much better position than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Jeremy, if I may, as much as you want to put the British in the same camp with the Europeans, I do want to ask one historical question, because I think the UK stands out in its attitude towards Russia, what you called Russophobia, or this adversarial positioning towards Moscow, has a very long history in the UK, dating back at least to the mid-19th century. And I think it's remarkably consistent. It persisted through the Tsarist, Bolshevik, Soviet, post-Soviet times. So it's not purely political in nature, because regardless of the political regime in the Kremlin, the UK seems to be very predisposed against Russia. And I wonder, what is it that makes this Russophobic line of the UK leadership so consistent?
I don't know. I mean, if you think about it, We fought together in the Second World War and cooperated very, very successfully. And it's very difficult to understand. I mean, I served throughout the Cold War and was trained and often trained to actually to fight against Russia. But when at the end of the war, at the end of the Cold War, we were starting to be involved in Partnership for Peace events, including with Russian colleagues. I'd been to St. Petersburg. And I was relieved that the Cold War was over and that we could actually start talking together and working together again. But I think that the problem that you're talking about is a problem that actually happens at the elite level. I don't think it's there amongst the majority of the British people. It's not only the elites, by which I mean the leadership in both diplomatic, political and military circles, but also in the mainstream media. You seem to hold on to it too, and I'm afraid to say that they've continued to convince themselves of Russia or Mr. Putin as a sort of Hitlerian villain, Zelensky as a Chechenian leader. All the while, it's forcing meaning that many of the British population just aren't told the truth, or certainly they're not given a balanced story. So the sooner that we can start to break out of this and see Russia for what it is, a proud country with significant power, a great power now, as it has proved, then the sooner we can actually understand that, the better, and actually rid ourselves of this terrible Russophobia. Unfortunately, it sits even in the British diplomatic service. And a friend of mine, Ian Proud, who I think you may have come across, was a diplomat in Moscow, was very disappointed at the way in which the British diplomatic service seemed to hold on to this Russophobia, for which there is no logical basis, and it certainly is in anything but the British interest to hold on to it. It would be much better for us to get into a much more measured and diplomatic relationship. Once again, rather than congratulating ourselves for not talking to Russia, it's imbecilic.
Now, speaking about diplomacy, we have another very fragile opening for the possibility of talks continuing in Istanbul between the Russians and the Ukrainians. And I think perhaps we both of us would agree that this reality-based worldview is helpful not only before the war, but also as you are trying to negotiate an end to it. And yet, as we look at the speeches of the European and the Ukrainian leaders, it seems that they are under the impression that they can get during the peace talks everything that they that was lost on the battlefield. I mean, Ukraine is demanding the return of all territories, reparation, what have you. It's like a loser takes all philosophy. You know, it's even hard for me to pose a question here. Do you think it's likely to lead to any fruitful resolution?
I think it's unlikely as long as the Ukrainians and the Europeans hold to that position. Although the thing that would make a difference would be for the Americans to decide, and I hope they do this, that they were going to walk away. I mean, the Americans are not without fault. We've got very good colleagues who talk, and they're very clear on the American role in this war, supported by the Europeans. But I think it's unlikely unless the Americans decide to walk away, at which stage I think then that will make a significant difference. What I think is more likely, though, is that the Americans will stay in, but in a hardly committed way, whilst the Europeans continue to support in a much more committed way the Ukrainians. What I would do in Mr. Putin's situation, I suspect this is what will happen, will be to continue my military operations until I'd achieve the security objective that I'm seeking to achieve. And I would guess that he would want his forces to go at least as far as the Dnieper River to open the buffer zones to the north of the campaign, but also to cross around the Kherson area and get past Odessa as far as Transnistria and essentially cut off that area. That way I would feel much more secure. And with that security, I might be in a more patient position to actually be able to think about a more diplomatic situation. I mean, it's not going to be an easy situation, but there is nothing to stop, in principle, Russia doing it. It's a question of time and military success on the battlefield, which will happen one way or another. So I think that's more likely. At any my guess is that if I were in Mr. Putin's situation, I would be saying to my military chiefs, continue with the strategy for against these objectives. I may ask you to stop at some stage, but we will continue till we've got to a position where Russia can and feel secure over the long term, and then we will take stock.
Now, whether or not there is any formal peace deal, I think we both would agree that this conflict has already upturned many of the assumptions of what makes a national economy strong enough to either, you know, withstand the sanctions or prepare and fight the war. And what I want to ask you is whether you think there will be any larger changes on how nations approach their economy building from now on, whether they continue lauding the service economy, or do you think perhaps they may invest more deliberately into the industrial capacity?
It's a very good question, Oksana. What the question rests on is a fundamental misunderstanding of the structure of economies, which is due to the use of GDP as your metric to assess economic strength. Now, when you look at, for example, France and Britain versus Russia, you would see that the Russian economy is a little bit bigger. But actually, when you look at the proportion of industrial capability, it's much, much higher in Russia. I think the Russian industrial capacity is at least five times Britain and France has put together. It's no good having an economy if you want to as a basis for power if it's based only on service sectors. I mean, it's difficult to throw loans over the battlefield. It's difficult to throw collateralized synthetic debt obligations and so on. So the first thing, if we're going to get any chance of really understanding this, we'll need to actually take apart the notion of gross domestic product as a way of understanding economies and start to think about it in a much more subtle and different way, which allows us to explore how economies can actually produce for their people.
Now, you also mentioned before that a large factor in calculating the balance of power is access to energy sources. And the West, particularly Europe, has invested heavily in the green energy or renewable energy field. If the West is indeed determined to go into direct conflict with Russia, as some of the European leaders seem to propose, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, do you think they can do that on green energy alone?
No, I'm absolutely convinced about it. I'm not against green energy. I work in the offshore sector, and I've been working in support of both the offshore oil and gas and the offshore wind sector. But the point is that at the moment, if you take the world's energy statistics, about 80% of the world's energy comes from hydrocarbons, about 10%. This is very rough and ready, 10% from nuclear and 10% from renewables. But the point about nuclear and renewables is they produce electricity. And really what are the critical issues in military operations and not electricity, although it's important for industrial production, but rather hydrocarbons, in particular diesel, as the critical fuel.
Well, you cannot run your tanks on solar panels, I suppose.
No, the chances of running anything on solar panels or renewable energy for the foreseeable future, at least the next 20 years, are extremely slim. You can run ships, of course, on nuclear energy and submarines on nuclear energy, and that's an area which we are experiencing. But electricity is a form of transmission of renewables, and renewables is not a good source for military operations. I doubt it ever will be. So again, this is another fundamental miscalculation, particularly by the Europeans. I think the Americans have a better understanding of it. And I think the Europeans have also failed to understand the role of energy in industrial production for war. Because you can have the best factories in the world, but if there's no electricity and no fuels to actually power those factories, they are as nothing. I think I made a point in an article that I wrote, the NATO article I wrote, to say that actually one of the key things that defeated Germany and defeated Japan in the Second World War was that the British, the Americans and the Russians had access to significant energy resources, and that they worked hard to make sure, first in the European campaign, that the Germans didn't gain access to Russian energy sources, and in the Japanese campaign to make sure that the Japan's access to Indonesian resources was cut off with the American anti-submarine campaign against that logistics train. So no, I mean, the fact is that we will need hydrocarbons are important for war, but I would also say that we ought not to be going to war at all if we can possibly help it, because it's a terribly bad use of energy to use it in war as opposed to for constructive purposes.
Well, Mr. Jeremy, I couldn't agree with you more on that point. We have to leave it there, though. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Oksana. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.